Chapter 2. Teresa DeBrito. My largest class was 29 kids. Oh, it was fun. 1. When Chepauk Valley Middle School was built to serve the children of the baby boom, 300 students spilled out of school buses every morning. The building had a line of double doors at the entrance to handle the crush, and the corridors inside seemed as busy as a highway. But that was long ago. The baby boom came and went. The bucolic corner of Connecticut, where Chepauk is located, with its charming colonial-era villages and winding country lanes, was discovered by wealthy families from New York City. Real estate prices rose. Younger families could no longer afford to live in the area. Enrollment dropped to 245 students, then to just over 200. There are now 80 children in the school's sixth grade. Based on the number of students coming up through the region's elementary schools, that number may soon be cut in half, which means that the average class size in the school will soon fall well below the national average. A once crowded school has become an intimate one. Would you send your child to Chepauk Valley Middle School? 2. The story of Vivek Ranadive and the Redwood City girls basketball team suggests that what we think of as an advantage and as a disadvantage is not always correct, that we mix the categories up. In this chapter and the next, I want to apply that idea to two seemingly simple questions about education. I say seemingly because they seem simple, although, as we will discover, they are really anything but. The Chepauk Valley Middle School question is the first of the two simple questions. My guess is that you'd be delighted to have your child in one of those intimate classrooms. Virtually everywhere in the world, parents and policymakers take it for granted that smaller classes are better classes. In the past few years, the governments of the United States, Britain, Holland, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, and China, to name just a few, have all taken major steps to reduce the size of their classrooms. When the governor of California announced sweeping plans to reduce the size of his state's classrooms, his popularity doubled within 3 weeks. Inside of a month, 20 other governors had announced plans to follow suit, and within a month and a half, the White House announced class size reduction plans of its own. To this day, 77% of Americans think that it makes more sense to use taxpayer money to lower class sizes than to raise teachers' salaries. Do you know how few things 77% of Americans agree on? There used to be as many as 25 students in a classroom at Chepauk Valley. Now that number is sometimes as low as 15. That means students at Chepauk get far more individual attention from their teacher than before, and common sense says that the more attention children get from their teacher, the better their learning experience will be. Students at the new, intimate Chepauk Valley ought to be doing better at school than students at the old, crowded Chepauk, right? It turns out that there is a very elegant way to test whether this is true. Connecticut has a lot of schools like Chepauk. It's a state with many small towns with small elementary schools, and small schools in small towns are subject to the natural ebbs and flows of birth rates and real estate prices, which means that a grade can be all but empty 1 year and crowded the next. Here are the enrollment records, for example, for the fifth grade in another Connecticut middle school. 1993, 18. 1994, 11. 1995, 17. 1996, 14. 1997, 13. 1998, 16. 1999, 15. 2000, 21. 2001, 23. 2002, 10. 2003, 18. 2004, 21. 2005, 18. In 2001, there were 23 fifth graders. The next year, there were 10. Between 2001 and 2002, everything else in that school remained the same. It had the same teachers, the same principal, the same textbooks. It was in the same building, in the same town. The local economy and the local population were virtually identical. The only thing that changed was the number of students in the fifth grade. If the children in the year with a small number of students did better than the children in the year with lots of students, then we can be pretty sure that it was because of the size of the class, right? This is what's called a natural experiment. Sometimes scientists set up formal experiments to try and test hypotheses. But on rare occasions, the real world provides a natural way of testing the same theory. And natural experiments have many advantages over formal experiments. So what happens if you use the natural experiment of Connecticut and compare the year-to-year results of every child who happens to have been in a small class with the results of those who happen to come along in years with lots of kids? The economist Carolyn Hauksbee has done just that, looking at every elementary school in the state of Connecticut, and here's what she found. Nothing. There are many studies that say they can't find a statistically significant effect of some policy change, Hauksbee says. That doesn't mean there wasn't an effect. It just means that they couldn't find it in the data. In this study, I found estimates that are very precisely estimated around the point zero. I got a precise zero. In other words, there is no effect. This is just one study, of course. But the picture doesn't get any clearer if you look at all the studies of class size, and there have been hundreds done over the years. 15% find statistically significant evidence that students do better in smaller classes. Roughly the same number find that students do worse in smaller classes. 20% are like Hauksbee's and find no effect at all, and the balance find a little bit of evidence in either direction that isn't strong enough to draw any real conclusions. The typical class size study concludes with a paragraph like this. In four countries, Australia, Hong Kong, Scotland, and the United States, our identification strategy leads to extremely imprecise estimates that do not allow for any confident assertion about class size effects. In two countries, Greece and Iceland, there seem to be non-trivial beneficial effects of reduced class sizes. France is the only country where there seem to be noteworthy differences between mathematics and science teaching. While there is a statistically significant and sizable class size effect in mathematics, a class size effect of comparable magnitude can be ruled out in science. The nine school systems for which we can rule out large-scale class size effects are Czech Republic, Korea, Portugal, Romania, Slovenia, and Spain. Finally, we can rule out any noteworthy causal effect of class size on student performance in two countries, Japan and Singapore. Did you follow that? After sorting through thousands of pages of data on student performance from 18 separate countries, the economists concluded that there were only two places in the world, Greece and Iceland, where there were non-trivial benefits to reduce class sizes. Greece and Iceland? The push to lower class sizes in the United States resulted in something like 250,000 new teachers being hired between 1996 and 2004. Over that same period, per pupil spending in the United States soared 21%, with nearly all of those many tens of billions of new dollars being spent on hiring those extra teachers. It's safe to say that there isn't a single profession in the world that has increased its numbers over the past two decades by as much or as quickly or at such expense as teaching has. One country after another has spent that kind of money because we look at a school like Chippewa Valley, where every teacher has a chance to get to know every student, and we think, there's the place to send my child. But the evidence suggests that the thing we are convinced is such a big advantage might not be such an advantage at all. 3. Not long ago, I sat down with one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. He began by talking about his childhood in Minneapolis. He would go up and down the streets of his neighborhood at the beginning of every winter, he said, getting commitments from people who wanted their driveways and sidewalks cleared of snow. Then he would contract out each job to other children in the neighborhood. He paid his workers the moment the job was done, with cash on hand, and collected from the families later, because he learned that was the surest way to get his crew to work hard. He had 8, sometimes 9 kids on the payroll. In the fall, he would switch to raking leaves. I would go and check their work so I could tell the customer that their driveway would be done the way they wanted it done, he remembered. There would always be one or two kids who didn't do it well, and I would have to fire them. He was 10 years old. By the age of 11, he had $600 in the bank, all earned by himself. This was in the 1950s. That would be the equivalent today of $5,000. I didn't have money for where I wanted to go, he said, with a shrug, as if it was obvious that an 11-year-old would have a sense of where he wanted to go. Any fool can spend money, but to earn it and save it and defer gratification, then you learn to value it differently. His family lived in what people euphemistically called a mixed neighborhood. He went to public schools and wore hand-me-downs. His father was a product of the Depression, and he talked plainly about money. The man from Hollywood said that if he wanted something, a new pair of running shoes, say, or a bicycle, his father would tell him he had to pay half. If he left the lights on, his father would show him the electric bill. He'd say, "Look, this is what we pay for electricity. You're just being lazy not turning the lights off. We're paying for you being lazy. But if you need the lights for working, 24 hours a day, no problem." The summer of his 16th year, he went to work at his father's scrap metal business. It was hard, physical labor. He was treated like any other employee. "It made me not want to live in Minneapolis," he said. "It made me never want to depend on working for my father. It was awful. It was dirty. It was hard. It was boring. It was putting scrap metal in barrels. I worked there from May 15th through Labor Day. I couldn't get the dirt off me. I think, looking back, my father wanted me to work there because he knew that if I worked there, I would want to escape. I would be motivated to do something more." In college, he ran a laundry service, picking up and delivering dry cleaning for his wealthy classmates. He organized student charter flights to Europe. He went to see basketball games with his friend and sat in terrible seats, obstructed by a pillar, and wondered what it would be like to sit in the premium seats courtside. He went to business school and law school in New York and lived in a bad neighborhood in Brooklyn to save money. After graduation, he got a job in Hollywood, which led to a bigger job and then to an even bigger job and side deals and prizes and a string of extraordinary successes to the point where he now has a house in Beverly Hills the size of an airplane hangar, his own jet, a Ferrari in the garage, and a gate in front of his seemingly never-ending driveway that looks like it was shipped over from some medieval castle in Europe. He understood money, and he understood money because he felt he had been given a thorough education in its value and function back home on the streets of Minneapolis. "I wanted to have more freedom. I wanted to aspire to have different things. Money was a tool that I could use for my aspiration and my desires and my drive," he said. "Nobody taught me that. I learned it. It was kind of like trial and error. I liked the juice of it. I got some self-esteem from it. I felt more control over my life." He was sitting in his home office as he said that, a room easily the size of most people's houses. And then he finally came to the point. He had children that he loved very dearly. Like any parent, he wanted to provide for them, to give them more than he had. But he had created a giant contradiction, and he knew it. He was successful because he had learned the long and hard way about the value of money and the meaning of work and the joy and fulfillment that come from making your own way in the world. But because of his success, it would be difficult for his children to learn those same lessons. Children of multimillionaires in Hollywood do not rake the leaves of their neighbors in Beverly Hills. Their fathers do not wave the electricity bill angrily at them if they leave the lights on. They do not sit in a basketball arena behind a pillar and wonder what it would be like to sit courtside. They live courtside. "My own instinct is that it's much harder than anybody believes to bring up kids in a wealthy environment," he said. "People are ruined by challenged economic lives. But they're ruined by wealth as well, because they lose their ambition, and they lose their pride, and they lose their sense of self-worth. It's difficult at both ends of the spectrum. There's some place in the middle which probably works best of all." There are few things that inspire less sympathy than a multimillionaire crying the blues for his children, of course. The man from Hollywood's children will never live in anything but the finest of houses and sit anywhere but in first class. But he wasn't talking about material comforts. He was a man who had made a great name for himself. One of his brothers had taken over the family scrap metal business and prospered. Another of his brothers had become a doctor and built a thriving medical practice. His father had produced three sons who were fulfilled and motivated and who had accomplished something for themselves in the world. And his point was that it was going to be harder for him, as a man with hundreds of millions of dollars, to be as successful in raising his children as his father had been back in a mixed neighborhood of Minneapolis. 4. The man from Hollywood is not the first person to have had this revelation. It is something, I think, that most of us understand intuitively. There is an important principle that guides our thinking about the relationship between parenting and money, and that principle is that more is not always better. It's hard to be a good parent if you have too little money. That much is obvious. Poverty is exhausting and stressful. If you have to work two jobs to make ends meet, it's hard to have the energy in the evening to read to your children before they go to bed. If you are a working, single parent, trying to pay your rent and feed and clothe your family and manage a long and difficult commute to a physically demanding job, it's hard to provide your children with the kind of consistent love and attention and discipline that makes for a healthy home. But no one would ever say that it's always true. The more money you have, the better parent you can be. The relationship between money and parenting is not linear, as a mathematician would say. Money makes parenting easier until a certain point, when it stops making much of a difference. What is that point? The scholars who research happiness suggest that more money stops making people happier at a family income of around $75,000 a year. After that, what economists call diminishing marginal returns sets in. If your family makes $75,000 and your neighbor makes $100,000, that extra $25,000 a year means that your neighbor can drive a nicer car and go out to eat slightly more often, but it doesn't make your neighbor happier than you or better equipped at doing the thousands of small and large things that make for being a good parent. But that only tells part of the story, doesn't it? Because when the income of parents gets high enough, then parenting starts to be harder again. For most of us, the values of the world we grew up in are not that different from the world we create for our children. But that's not true for someone who becomes very wealthy. The psychologist James Grubman uses the wonderful expression immigrants to wealth to describe first-generation millionaires, by which he means that they face the same kinds of challenges in relating to their children that immigrants to any new country face. Someone like the Hollywood mogul grew up in the old country of the middle class, where scarcity was a great motivator and teacher. His father taught him the meaning of money and the virtues of independence and hard work. But his children live in the new world of riches, where the rules are different and baffling. How do you teach work hard, be independent, learn the meaning of money to children who look around themselves and realize that they never have to work hard, be independent, or learn the meaning of money? That's why so many cultures around the world have a proverb to describe the difficulty of raising children in an atmosphere of wealth. In English, the saying is, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. The Italians say, from stars to stables. In Spain, it's, he who doesn't have it, does it, and he who has it, misuses it. Wealth contains the seeds of its own destruction. A parent has to set limits, but that's one of the most difficult things for immigrants to wealth, because they don't know what to say when having the excuse of, we can't afford it, is gone, Grubman says. They don't want to lie and say, we don't have the money, because if you have a teenager, the teenager says, excuse me, you have a Porsche and mom has a Maserati. The parents have to learn to switch from, no, we can't, to, no, we won't. But no, we won't, Grubman said, is much harder. No, we can't is simple. Sometimes as a parent, you have to say it only once or twice. It doesn't take long for the child of a middle-class family to realize that it is pointless to ask for a pony, because a pony simply can't happen. No, we won't get a pony requires a conversation and the honesty and skill to explain that what is possible is not always what is right. I'll walk wealthy parents through the scenario, and they have no idea what to say, Grubman said. I have to teach them. Yes, I can buy that for you, but I choose not to. It is not consistent with our values. But then that, of course, requires that you have a set of values and know how to articulate them and know how to make them plausible to your child, all of which are really difficult things for anyone to do under any circumstances, and especially if you have a Ferrari in the driveway, a private jet, and a house in Beverly Hills the size of an airplane hangar. The man from Hollywood had too much money. That was his problem as a parent. He was well past the point where money made things better, and well past the point where money stopped mattering all that much, He was at the point where money starts to make the job of raising normal and well-adjusted children more difficult. If you had to draw a graph describing the man from Hollywood's predicament, it would look like a camel's hump. The curve would start out positive, then go neutral, then turn negative. That's what's called an inverted U-curve. U-shaped curves are hard to understand. They almost never fail to take us by surprise, and one of the reasons we are so often confused about advantages and disadvantages is that we forget when we are operating in a U-shaped world. Which brings us back to the puzzle of class size. What if the relationship between the number of children in a classroom and academic performance is not linear? What if it's not diminishing marginal returns? What if, in fact, it's an inverted U-shaped curve? The principal of Chepauk Valley Middle School is a woman named Teresa DeBrito. In her 5-year tenure at the school, she has watched the incoming class dwindle year by year. To a parent, that might seem like good news. But when she thought about it, she had the U-shaped curve in mind. In a few years, we're going to have fewer than 50 kids for the whole grade coming up from elementary school, she said. She was dreading it. We're going to struggle. 5. Inverted U-shaped curves have 3 parts, and each part follows a different logic. There's the left side, where doing more or having more makes things better. There's the flat middle, where doing more doesn't make much of a difference. And there's the right side, where doing more or having more makes things worse. If you think about the class size puzzle this way, then what seems baffling starts to make a little more sense. The number of students in a class is like the amount of money a parent has. It all depends on where you are on the curve. Israel, for example, has historically had quite large elementary school classes. The country's educational system uses the Maimonides rule, named after the 12th century rabbi who decreed that classes should not exceed 40 children. That means elementary school classes can often have as many as 38 or 39 students. Where there are 40 students in a grade, though, the same school could suddenly have 2 classes of 20. If you do a Hauksbee-style analysis and compare the performance of one of those big classes with a class of 20, the small class will do better. That shouldn't be surprising. 36 or 37 students is a lot for any teacher to handle. Israel is on the left side of the inverted U-curve. Now think back to Connecticut. In the schools Hauksbee looked at, most of the variation was between class sizes in the mid to low 20s and those in the high teens. When Hauksbee says that her study found nothing, what she means is that she could find no real benefit to making classes smaller in that medium range. Somewhere between Israel and Connecticut, in other words, the effects of class size move along the curve to the flat middle, where adding resources to the classroom stops translating into a better experience for children. Why isn't there much of a difference between a class of 25 students and a class of 18 students? There's no question that the latter is easier for the teacher, fewer papers to grade, fewer children to know and follow. But a smaller classroom only translates to a better outcome if teachers change their teaching style when given a lower workload. And what the evidence suggests is that in this mid-range, teachers don't necessarily do that. They just work less. This is only human nature. Imagine that you are a doctor and you suddenly learn that you'll see 20 patients on a Friday afternoon instead of 25 while getting paid the same. Would you respond by spending more time with each patient? Or would you simply leave at 6:30 instead of 7:30 and have dinner with your kids? Now for the crucial question. Can a class be too small, the same way a parent can make too much money? I polled a large number of teachers in the United States and Canada and asked them that question, and teacher after teacher agreed that it can. Here's a typical response. My perfect number is 18. That's enough bodies in the room that no one person needs to feel vulnerable, but everyone can feel important. 18 divides handily into groups of 2 or 3 or 6, all varying degrees of intimacy in and of themselves. With 18 students, I can always get to each one of them when I need to. 24 is my second favorite number. The extra 6 bodies make it even more likely that there will be a dissident among them, a rebel or two to challenge the status quo. But the trade-off with 24 is that it verges on having the energetic mass of an audience instead of a team. Add 6 more of them to hit 30 bodies, and we've weakened the energetic connections so far that even the most charismatic of teachers can't maintain the magic all the time. And what about the other direction? Drop down 6 from the perfect 18 bodies, and we have the Last Supper. And that's the problem. 12 is small enough to fit around the holiday dinner table. Too intimate for many high schoolers to protect their autonomy on the days they need to, and too easily dominated by the bombast or bully, either of whom could be the teacher herself. By the time we shrink to 6 bodies, there is no place to hide at all, and not enough diversity in thought and experience to add the richness that can come from numbers. The small class is, in other words, potentially as difficult for a teacher to manage as the very large class. In one case, the problem is the number of potential interactions to manage. In the other case, it is the intensity of the potential interactions. As another teacher memorably put it, when a class gets too small, the students start acting like siblings in the back seat of a car. There is simply no way for the cantankerous kids to get away from one another. Here's another comment from a high school teacher. He had recently had a class of 32 and hated it. When I face a class that large, the first thought I have is, damn it, every time I collect something to mark, I'm going to spend hours of time here at the school when I could be with my own kids. But he didn't want to teach a class of fewer than 20 either. The life source of any class is discussion, and that tends to need a certain critical mass to get going. I teach classes right now with students who simply don't discuss anything, and it's brutal at times. If the numbers get too low, discussion suffers. That seems counterintuitive, because I would think that the quiet kids who would hesitate to speak in a class of 32 would do so more readily in a class of 16. But that hasn't been my experience. The quiet ones tend to be quiet regardless. And if the class is too small among the speakers, you don't have enough breadth of opinion, perhaps, to get things really going. There's also something very hard to pin down about energy level. A very small group tends to lack that sort of energy that comes from the friction between people. And a really, really small class? Beware. Here's one more teacher. I had a class of 9 students in grade 12 academic French. Sounds like a dream, doesn't it? It was a nightmare. You can't get any kind of conversation or discussion going in the target language. It's difficult to play games to reinforce vocabulary, grammar skills, etc. The momentum just isn't there. The economist Jesse Levin has done some fascinating work along these same lines, looking at Dutch school children. He counted how many peers children had in their class, that is, students at a similar level of academic ability, and found that the number of peers had a surprising correlation with academic performance, particularly for struggling students. In other words, if you are a student, particularly a poor student, what you need is to have people around you asking the same questions, wrestling with the same issues, and worrying about the same things as you are, so that you feel a little less isolated and a little more normal. This is the problem with really small classes, Levin argues. When there are too few students in a room, the chances that children are surrounded by a critical mass of other people like them starts to get really low. Taken too far, Levin says, class size reduction steals away the peers that struggling students learn from. Can you see why Teresa de Brito was so worried about Chepauk Valley? She's the principal of a middle school, teaching children at precisely the age when they begin to make the difficult transition to adolescence. They are awkward and self-conscious and anxious about seeming too smart. Getting them to engage, to move beyond simple question and answer sessions with their teacher, she said, can be like pulling teeth. She wanted lots of interesting and diverse voices in her classrooms, and the kind of excitement that comes from a critical mass of students grappling with the same problem. How do you do that in a half-empty room? The more students you have, she continued, the more variety you can have in those discussions. If it's too small with kids this age, it's like they have a muzzle on. She didn't say it, but you could imagine her thinking that if someone went and built a massive subdivision on the gently rolling meadow next to the school, she wouldn't be all that unhappy. I started in Meriden as a middle school math teacher, DeBrito went on. Meriden is a middle and lower income city in another part of the state. My largest class was 29 kids. She talked about how hard that was, how much work it took to follow and know and respond to that many students. You've got to be able to have eyes in the back of your head. You've got to be able to hear what's happening when you're working with a particular group. You have to really be on top of your game when you have that many kids in a classroom so that over there in a corner, they're not just talking about something that has nothing to do with what they're supposed to be working on. But then she made a confession. She liked teaching that class. It was one of the best years of her career. The great struggle for someone teaching math to 12 and 13-year-olds is to make it seem exciting. And 29 kids was exciting. There were so many more peers to interact with, she said. They weren't always relating with just this one group. There was more opportunity to vary your experiences. And that's the real issue. What can be done to enliven, enrich, and engage the child so they aren't just being passive? Did she want 29 children in every classroom at Chipog? Of course not. DeBrito knew that she was a bit unusual and that the ideal number for most teachers was lower than that. Her point was simply that on the question of class size, we have become obsessed with what is good about small classrooms and oblivious of what can also be good about large classes. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to have an educational philosophy that thinks of the other students in the classroom with your child as competitors for the attention of the teacher and not allies in the adventure of learning. When she thought back to that year in Meriden, DeBrito got a faraway look in her eyes. I liked the noise. I liked to hear them interact. Oh, it was fun. 6. A half-hour drive up the road from Chipog Valley, in the town of Lakeville, Connecticut, is a school called Hotchkiss. It is considered one of the premier private boarding schools in the United States. Tuition is almost $50,000 a year. The school has 2 lakes, 2 hockey rinks, 4 telescopes, a golf course, and 12 pianos. And not just any pianos, but as the school takes pains to point out, Steinway pianos, the most prestigious piano money can buy. Hotchkiss is the kind of place that spares no expense in the education of its students. The school's average class size, 12. The same condition that Teresa DeBrito dreads, Hotchkiss, just stopped the road, advertises as its greatest asset. Our learning environment, the school proudly declares, is intimate, interactive, and inclusive. Why does a school like Hotchkiss do something that so plainly makes its students worse off? One answer is that the school isn't thinking of its students. It's thinking of the parents of its students who see things like golf courses and Steinway pianos and small classes as evidence that their $50,000 a year is well spent. But the better answer is that Hotchkiss has simply fallen into the trap that wealthy people and wealthy institutions and wealthy countries, that Goliaths, all too often fall into. The school assumes that the kinds of things that wealth can buy always translate into real-world advantages. They don't, of course. That's the lesson of the inverted U-curve. It is good to be bigger and stronger than your opponent. It is not so good to be so big and strong that you're a sitting duck for a rock fired at 150 miles per hour. Goliath didn't get what he wanted because he was too big. The man from Hollywood was not the parent he wanted to be because he was too rich. Hotchkiss is not the school it wants to be because its classes are too small. We all assume that being bigger and stronger and richer is always in our best interest. Vivek Ranadeve, a shepherd boy named David, and the principal of Chipog Valley Middle School, will tell you that it isn't.